No, believe me, I get it. It's a totally fair question. What in the heck is going on over in China anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 7th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Total elapsed time for the trading session in Shanghai on this Thursday, 14 minutes. That's how long it took for traders to decide they didn't like what the Bank of China was doing with the currency, the yuan, pushing it down, making it cheaper, trying to boost the slowing Chinese economy. Traders read between the lines, as they always do. Circuit breakers were tripped, and by 10 in the morning, Shanghai time, the main stock index there was off 7%. Trading had been called for the day. So we got our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, on the line to get some all-important context on this whole thing. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
Rob, you and I have talked before about the confidence that people in China have about the grasp that the People's Bank of China and the government have on the economy over there and what's going on. I imagine this whole thing today did nothing to fix that.
No, it didn't. But, you know, when you look at China's real economy, it could be a different type of thing. You know, China's stock market is more of a theater performance. And lately, it's been sort of a confusing, bumbling show because nobody seems to be directing it. But when you peel back the layers and you go beyond the stock market, or China's even half-baked GDP figures, and you look at the real situation on the ground, it's a little more complicated. You know, in the cities like Shanghai and Beijing, everything appears to be normal. But out in the provinces where most of China lives and works, you know, there are some problems brewing. You know, I spoke to Peking University economist Christopher Balding about what he looks at when he runs a diagnostic check on China's economy, and here's what he told me.
I look at things like non-performing loans. Okay. If you think of like the mortgage-backed securities in the United States that triggered the subprime crisis and all of those bad loans, China has enormous amounts of bad loans that they just aren't dealing with.
So basically what he's talking about here is a situation you've got in most of the country. You've got developers or companies taking out loans to buy assets like real estate, and those assets are used to get additional loans. So you've got loans on top of loans on top of loans. And if one of those loans goes bad, you've suddenly got a domino effect. And then you've got failed banks and you sort of know the rest. And it's lack of investor confidence from this week's crashing stock market is not going to help the situation at all. So it's already shaping up to be a tough year for China's economy.
Get me down on the streets, though, Rob. When you and the family go out to dinner or when you stop by to shop someplace on your way home from the bureau, what are people talking about? What's on their minds?
I think most people are pretty much sheltered from what's going on in the stock market in China. You know, most Chinese aren't involved in the stock market. Not many people have shares. And so right. I think when you go out and I talk to my Chinese friends, you know, they're talking about it, but they're not talking about it in a sense that it could hurt them. Like, you know, when Americans talk about a stock market crash, you know, we're all invested in our stock market. So that's a big hit to everyone, right? It could be a hit to our pensions and you know, our own wealth. But for Chinese, I think that they're just seeing it as more or less a theater performance. And I think that what they're worried about is are other things. You know, they're worried about, you know, the entire economy, the real economy sort of imploding. And that's something that they seem to be more interested in talking about.
I don't want to do too much forecasting here, Rob, but tomorrow morning when the Bank of China fixes the exchange rate on the yuan, give me a guess. What's going to happen?
Tomorrow, I would assume that China is going to prop up the market tomorrow. It's probably going to look normal. But believe me, behind the scenes, it is anything but normal.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for us, talking about the chaos in the Chinese markets the past couple of days. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
All right, so let's move on from, I guess you'd call it financial China, right, to real China. Because once you do the regression analysis and you take stocks in the markets out of the equation, what is the actual economic impact of a slowing Chinese economy on the rest of us, on the rest of the world? For that, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington.
Always keep this in mind. When the Chinese stock market sneezes, no one necessarily catches a cold. David Dollar at the Brookings Institution is a former China country director for the World Bank.
You and I cannot easily buy stocks on the onshore Chinese stock market. We don't have to worry that Americans have lost a lot of money. That's not happening. The market is you know, fairly closed.
What really matters is the physical stuff bought and sold, or not sold to China, as is the case today, especially commodities, when an index of metals and minerals prices plunged to half of last year's level. Michael Herberg at the National Bureau of Asian Research says this is not a short-term business cycle slowdown. China's whole economy is shifting away from smokestacks and cement mixers to consumers.
It's created enormous overcapacity in steel, aluminum, glass, cement, and that's driven a huge decline in Chinese consumption of all these basic commodities.
Including oil. China is the biggest, most important buyer of Saudi crude. And oil is created in part because China's car sales have fallen from 20% growth to 5%. Auto consultant Michael Dunn is the author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads.
Consumer confidence is not what it used to be. The other thing going on is that the cities are congested like never before, and the governments are making it more and more difficult to buy cars.
Cars with a popular bumper sticker that kind of reflects today's world economy, confronting a slowing, transforming China. It reads, "Sorry, novice." I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Sorry, novice. Yeah, it was ugly on Wall Street today. Real, real ugly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Facebook and its founder Mark Zuckerberg have been having a rough go of it in India of late. The company's been working on a free internet program over there, Free Basics, it's called. But there have been loud and plentiful objections raised over restrictions on which websites can be visited, what'll happen to all the data that will be gathered. And so late last month, Indian regulators suspended the service pending an investigation. The BBC's South Asia correspondent Justin Rowlett filed this dispatch.
You would think people would be grateful to be offered something for nothing. Well, that ain't necessarily so, as Facebook's youthful founder is finding out in India. With 130 million users, India is already Facebook's second biggest market in the world. Mr. Zuckerberg got a bear hug when he met the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Silicon Valley late last year, and the degree of opposition has clearly taken him and his company by surprise. But maybe the real problem is how this offer has been presented. Mr. Zuckerberg talks about Free Basics as if it were an act of charity. He's equated what he's offering with the provision of essential services like free basic education and healthcare. Many Indians, proud of the freedom they gained from the country's British colonisers, don't want some foreign billionaire telling them which services they must use and which sites they can visit. What's more, they don't like to accept handouts from anyone, particularly when they suspect the gift is really part of a strategy to gouge profits in the future. But this debate will soon be over. Today is the deadline for comment on the issue. It will then be up to the Indian telecoms regulator to decide the future of the service. For Marketplace, this is Justin Rowlett in Delhi.
One hears a lot, especially in the high-tech boom that we're having, of internet companies selling for billions of dollars, making founders and investors insanely rich. One hears not quite as much about companies that sell for far, far less, leaving sometimes angry and disappointed people in their wake. That latter category is what we're talking about right now, specifically the Gilt Group. Though the Fashion Flash sale site had been valued at $1 billion, let me say that again, Fashion Flash sale site, it had been valued at $1 billion, the owner of Saks Fifth Avenue bought it for $250 million. That's not nothing, but it is well short of what Gilt and its investors had once hoped. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York now on how flash sale websites fell out of fashion.
Gilt was a gleaming unicorn that turned into a mangy little pony, desperate for the nearest barn with a salt lick. Other flash sellers like home design site One Kings Lane are basically in the same spot. To understand why they cratered, zip back to the time when most of them rose to fame, during the depths of the recession. Sucharita Mulpuru follows retail at Forrester Research.
At that time, there was actually quite a bit of excess inventory because a lot of companies had a lot of inventory that they weren't able to sell.
Enter flash sellers. They bought that inventory on the cheap. Clothes, housewares, then they marked them up and sold them for a limited time. Shoppers and tech investors ate it up. But as the economy improved, there weren't piles of unsold stuff sitting around anymore. Former Neiman Marcus Senior Vice President Stephen Dennis now runs Sageberry Consulting.
The amount of really good inventory that could be sold at 60 or 70% just couldn't possibly be available to meet the demand.
That put ever-growing numbers of flash sellers in a tougher fight with bigger discount players who improved their digital presence. Places like Saks Off Fifth on the high end, TJ Maxx on the other. Paula Rosenblum is managing partner at RSR Research.
As a standalone entity, flash sale sites don't make a lot of long-term sense. As a piece of an overall offering, they make all the sense in the world.
Saks agrees. Gilt gives it a new channel to move fashion at a discount and access to younger shoppers. And it gets it at some 75% off. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
In actual news coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show this week, as opposed to whiz-bang gadget news, there's word that Netflix has expanded its streaming service to another 130 countries. Did it in one fell swoop, too, and so brought the number of countries that can now binge-watch House of Cards to something like 190. China is the big one not included in that list. Netflix says it's working on it, but I digress. A lot of the places where people woke up to Netflix this morning are in the developing world, some of which just don't have great online access. A problem for an internet streaming company, right? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on the challenges that come with rolling out a project to pretty much the whole world at once.
Mohammed Samir loves movies. He's 34 and produces and directs independent films in Egypt. He had heard of Netflix before and thought it was an interesting model.
So when I read yesterday that Netflix will open all over the world, right away I just went to my Apple TV today and set up the account.
He took the free trial and says he'll probably pay for a subscription once it's done, which is exactly what Netflix wants from its brand new audience in the developing world.
For me as an audience and also for me as a filmmaker and looking for places to distribute my films, this is a very good message.
Picking up local content is going to be important for this rollout, says Dan Rayburn. He researches streaming media at consulting firm Frost & Sullivan.
You know, the one thing with any service like Netflix is when you roll into more countries, you have to have content that subscribers in those specific countries or regions want to watch.
Netflix management has already committed to spending $5 billion this year on content. But in many of the new countries, the internet is really slow. Robert Tashima of Oxford Business Group works throughout Africa.
The customers are in place. The need is in place. At the moment, it's just that last mile of connectivity in terms of the internet, which is really lacking.
Tashima says bandwidth is expanding throughout the continent, and now Netflix is well positioned to take advantage. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
snack makers, including Wheat Thins manufacturer Mondelez, are always trying to think of new ways to incentivize consumers to buy another box of their snacks, right?
Yes, yes, they are. Less is once again more. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah. So the Dow Industrial's off 392 points today, 2.3%, closed at 16,514. The NASDAQ off 146 points, 3%, 4689. The S&P 500 down 47 points, 2.3% there as well, 1943 there. JCPenney and Macy's were rare bright spots in today's market sell-off. Investors rewarded Macy's plans to cut payroll and close stores with a 2% jump in the share price. JCPenney posted a nice bump in holiday sales. Its shares were up nearly 4% today. We just talked about Netflix's simultaneous move into 130 overseas markets. Investors weren't impressed. The stock disconnected 2.6%. Facebook, told you about that as well. It clicked down nearly 5% today. Apple, even mighty Apple, gave back 4.2%. There is no joy in Mudville, I suppose, or Cupertino. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You want to know the direction of the NFL, where the league is almost literally headed? Forget the playoffs this weekend. Pay attention instead to the owners' meetings next week. That's when we're going to get the first inkling of which team or teams are going to move to Los Angeles. The Rams, the San Diego Chargers, and the Raiders have all filed paperwork to make that switch. The teams have also all tried to get new stadiums built where they are. But as often happens, negotiations have fallen apart over building costs that can top $1 billion or more per stadium. But with those prospective moves to L.A., the three teams in play say they want to offer fans a new stadium experience. Marketplace's Andy Baxter looks at what that means, bottom line.
Among the features of the new stadium experience, a lot more clubs and lounges to hang out in. Here's Don Murray, a facilities reporter with Sports Business Journal.
These hospitality spaces play a huge role in kind of escalating the experience.
Then there are the technological bells and whistles. Ubiquitous Wi-Fi, the ability to order food and drinks right at your seat via an app and have your grub brought to you. Jeff Knappel is head of Van Wagner Sports and Entertainment. He worked on the latest NFL stadium set to open in Minnesota this year. And Knappel says old stadiums just aren't wired to make all the new tech stuff work easily.
How do I create an environment where people can bring and are operating off of their second device and still have it not crash?
Knappel says another part of the new stadium experience can include exclusive game video that fans can't get at home.
Different kinds of replays that people could see from angles and so forth while they're sitting in the seats.
But is it still worth spending $1 or $2 billion on a new stadium instead of just rehabbing the old one? Knappel says new ones generate more revenue, like advertising and naming rights, and stadiums serve another important purpose, according to Paul Swangard at the University of Oregon.
There's a lot of literature that still suggests that the way you become a fan of a sport is often your ability to experience that sport live.
But still, the competition from home viewing is stiff. PricewaterhouseCoopers projects that in the next couple years, the North American sports industry will likely see more revenue from media deals than from tickets. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
I'm going to set up this next story with a list of companies that all have something in common, something bad, I should say. J.P. Morgan, Dairy Queen, eBay. Got it yet? All right, so these two will give it away, Target and Sony. And believe me, I could go on. They're all companies that have been hacked. Millions of people affected, millions, probably billions, actually, of dollars by now lost. So there's huge demand for people smart in cybersecurity. The catch is the companies say they can't find enough of those workers to meet the demand that exists. So a program in Silicon Valley is trying to get more people interested in cybersecurity, and they are starting them young. Sam Harnett reports.
We're in a room full of fourth graders learning about computer code. These kids know the basics, even which language they're in.
C++.
No, that's what it is. C++.
This after-school course was developed by nearby San Jose State University. It's designed to encourage an interest in cybersecurity that might someday turn into a job. In the class, kids are typing up the code and fixing any errors they made. You know, bugs.
Instead of putting N, I put M, and this one I forgot to put in N.
James Estrella is showing me the bug in his code. It could break his whole program, he says. Or worse, let someone hack into it.
This is weird. Like, on one little tiny mistake, and then it affects everything. That's really weird.
The instructor, David Macias, says the kids have quickly realized how much of the world around them is hackable.
There was a lot of, like, I can make games, I can make this, and then they took a step back and said, whoa, wait a minute, someone can hack me, someone can hack my phone, someone can hack my car, and they just started going off with stories about, like, oh, someone hacked this, someone hacked that.
The road to a well-paying job in cybersecurity is long and complex. Employers require special certifications, which take years of experience to obtain.
Hey, we have a problem.
Matt Siegelman is CEO of the job analytics firm Burning Glass Technologies. He says there isn't a good pipeline to fill industry demand for cybersecurity workers. His firm put out a report showing that the number of cybersecurity job openings has nearly doubled in the last 6 years.
Today, what you're seeing is that Main Street industry, large businesses, small businesses, are sweating this stuff. And they should be.
Hackers are going after companies left and right. But kids aren't learning about cybersecurity until college, says Virginia Lemkol-Dakwe. She developed these cybersecurity courses, which now run from third grade through high school. At first, she says, they raised a lot of eyebrows.
Believe me, cybersecurity was not anything anybody was thinking about.
But for her, it's a no-brainer. It's interesting, educational, and there are jobs.
The realization is that this is a lucrative and interesting pathway, and let's expose our kids to this early.
Some may discover that they've got what it takes to go into cybersecurity, that they love breaking things apart, seeing how they work, obsessing over code. Those people are rare, says Thomas Austin. He's a professor of computer science at San Jose State University.
Maybe the mindset's the hardest thing to train. Maybe we can't train it. I don't know.
Austin says you can tell which kids are already hooked on cybersecurity.
There's definitely kids who are up on all the latest security exploits, and occasionally have that embarrassing moment where they're more up on something than I am. Like, oh, yeah, okay, I got some reading to do.
Maybe James Estrella will grow up to be one of those kids. He proudly shows me the computer code he's typed up, and I can't help asking him that dumb thing adults always ask kids.
So do you think this is something you might want to do? Do you like programming?
Yeah, I want to be an engineer in the future, so yeah, I'll do it.
Estrella says he already knows more about computers than his parents.
The more I get used to it, I think the more it's easier for me.
He says to have good security, you just need to get rid of the bugs in your code. Oh, and to make strong passwords. Otherwise, he says, you could get hacked. In San Jose, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Only in capitalism is a cracker that is 0.12 inches thick too thick. 14% too thick, to be precise. You think I'm kidding here, but I'm really not. There is on the market now something called even thinner Wheat Thins. And thin as they are, they speak volumes about snacking in America circa 2016. Vanessa Wong writes on food for BuzzFeed. We talk to her every now and then. Vanessa, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
I guess the question has to be on these thinner Wheat Thins, why?
Right. That's an excellent question.
I know.
So snack makers, including Wheat Thins manufacturer Mondelez, are always trying to think of new ways to incentivize consumers to buy another box of their snacks, right? So now they have launched a limited edition Wheat Thins called Even Thinner Wheat Thins, which are 14% thinner than original Wheat Thins, believe it or not.
No, I believe it. I saw the measurements in your article. But you point out, and this is something that's been going on in America for a long time, portion control is where it's at in weight control, right? And in watching what you eat. And I guess they're trying to get some of that action here.
Absolutely. So it's no coincidence that they launched these right around the new year when everyone's thinking about resolutions. Yeah. And so it's one of the reasons why Mondelez has also launched like even thinner Oreos or Oreo Thins last year. And there was a line of ultra-thin sliced cheese that Sargento launched that a market researcher, Nielsen, called a breakthrough innovation. It sold really well in the grocery store because the lower calorie count had strong appeal with consumers. So we might be fooling ourselves, but, you know, as far as manufacturers are concerned, yeah, it's working.
Talk to me for a second about, you know, snack foods in general, right? Because we're all trying to be healthy. We're all trying to, you know, cut down and watch it. What's the environment out there for snack foods writ large?
Snacks are actually doing really great. Surprisingly, while sales of other types of manufactured packaged foods like cereal have gone down, snack food sales have been very strong for some companies. There's a trend right now towards like eating small portions of food all day. Yeah. And there are new types of snacks that have come out that have been very popular, new types of like alternative chips made of things that aren't potatoes.
Yeah, and but that's just not right.
Like kale chips, you know, who knows if kale chips will ever be like the next great American snack.
No, I'm just going to say it right here. No, I'm just saying.
But yeah, I mean, all the more competition for old school wheat cracker.
This comes, we should say, on the backdrop of a tough year for crackers in 2015.
Right. So crackers did have a tough year. Unit sales of all crackers in the country fell by 2.3% last year. And wheat crackers specifically fell a lot. So it's, you know, about time that Wheat Thins came up with something that people wanted to munch on.
Now, have you tasted them? Do they taste the same?
So I'm not sure if I'm really fooling myself. They did taste different to me.
No
they were
way.
Kind
oh,
of
close your eyes. Do the blindfolded
crunchier.
Thing. No way. Seriously?
Yeah, they were. they were kind of crunchier, but like not meaningfully crunchier. And they were smaller, but also not meaningfully smaller to, you know, where I would like do something different with it. It just felt like, you know, it felt like a 14% smaller Wheat Thins. So.
Vanessa Wong covers food and all kinds of stuff at BuzzFeed. Vanessa, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today is something a little bit different. Found it online this afternoon. I guess you'd call it a public radio tribute album, I suppose. I'm just going to let the tape speak for itself here.
Dow Industrial was off 130 points today, 0.7%, closed at 17,749. Blue chips gained 265, the NASDAQ up 50 points, S&P 500 gained 13%. Bond prices rose, but your ass stayed broke because you have no idea what any of this means, and you've never invested a single dollar in the stock market, and you're listening because it's on your drive home. So tell me, are you going to do the numbers, or are the numbers going to do you?
It goes on from there. It's amazing. TJ Reynolds is his name. Just Do Records is the label behind this obvious masterpiece. We've got a link to it on our website. Seriously, check it out. It's really good. The Dow off 392 points today, 2.3%. The NASDAQ off 146 points. That is 3%. The S&P 500 dropped 47 points, 2.3%. Who knows what tomorrow is going to bring? John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.